Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Charles Hugh Smith. He's author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of several books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, The Nearly Free University and the Emerging Economy, Pathfinding Our Destiny, Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic, and most recently, Will You Be Richer or Poorer? His blog, oftwominds.com, is one of CNBC's top alternative finance sites. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard, and I'm looking forward to our discussion today on a topic that's of great interest to a lot of people, inflation, and whether it's transitory or is this a secular cyclical change.
Yeah, exactly. There's been a lot of talk about it. The sort of insight that people are providing from central banks and governments is that it's nothing to worry about. It's transitory, short term, but maybe it is long term and secular. So let's explore that question and see if there's any indications that can give us clues to whether it is transitory or secular. And if you wanted to give an overview first, what your thoughts are.
Yeah, thank you, Richard. Well, because I'm old, I can remember the gas and oil crisis of 1973-74, which was like the oil shock that was sort of a precursor or the trigger to some degree of nearly a decade of higher inflation. I also remember the change in yields, that interest rates were going up through this inflationary 70s until they peaked at, I think about 18% or so in 1981. And then we've had a secular periods for the last 40 years where yields have been declining and inflation has been either declining or stable at low levels. And so I think one of the things I think about is nothing lasts forever. And so after 40 years, that's actually a really long cycle for yields to be declining and for inflation to be sort of quiescent. And so it would be timely to, in other words, that we can expect a change in trend for whatever reason. And I think that in terms of the big reasons, I think we can look at neoliberal globalization, which of course has been active since the early 80s and gathered momentum in the late 90s and early 2000s. The reason why I'm discussing that is, of course, with globalization, then you're accessing a lot of markets and commodities that were inaccessible because there was insufficient local capital. They didn't have the technology or the tools. And globalization created a tremendous surge in supply of commodities, developing world economies got a huge boost by having access to global markets. And so you saw like new discoveries of say oil in parts of Africa. You saw a tremendous expansion of soybean production in Brazil and so on and so forth. So there was a huge burst of supply into the global supply chain. And that, of course, moderated inflation, right? Because supply and demand were favorable. And so now I think we're entering a period where we can already see that shortages and scarcities are occurring, that demand has now absorbed all the supply that came online over the last several decades. And as the developing world grew wealthier, then global demand is actually now outstripping supply. And there's that's, I think, a secular change. I don't know if you're seeing evidence for that or not.
Yes, seeing that, and as well, the recent catalyst of the entire post-COVID era in terms of supply chain disruptions, right, is providing a catalyst to all of these factors that you see. And you've actually made a list of 10 of the drivers of what you see as secular sea change in inflation. So maybe we can go through each one in more detail. You can elaborate on each one. The first one is on demographics.
Yeah, and I think those of us who follow demographics, it's no surprise, but the global workforce is finally starting to shrink here in many countries, including China. The reason is that for a variety of reasons, birth rates were declining over the last several generations. In many countries, the developed world especially, but also the developing world. And in the case of China, of course, the famous one child per household policy and aging populations. So we're seeing that the secular cycle of an expanding workforce, which provided a lot of supply, so employers didn't have to overpay because it was a cheap labor force somewhere in the world that you could hire. Well, that's in many cases has reversed, and now there's fewer workers, and so there's just a supply-demand imbalance in favor of labor for the first time in 40 years instead of in favor of capital. And so the labor shortages are visible in countries like with low birth rates like Japan, but they're also visible here in the U.S. as the baby boom generation of workers retires. And of course, it's well known that many older workers are continuing to work past conventional retirement age. But this is, we're finding that after the COVID, the pandemic, that a lot of older workers who left the workforce or were laid off are not coming back. And so what I think we're seeing is selective shortages of labor that it's very difficult to replace. And for instance, ICU physicians, it takes a decade of training in order to be an effective ICU physician. And so you can't just print those like you can print money. and it's not just there's kind of high level skills such as physicians. There's also a shortage of pipe fitters, plumbers, and so on in a lot of the manual trades. So I guess my point here is there's a demographic pressure that's reversed, and now there's a shortage of workers globally. And then there's more specific shortages and very difficult to replace fields where the training is very long. And so the pressure, of course, is going to be to poach labor from somebody else by offering more money. And so this is already putting pressure on wages. And
Number three, a laborer's demand, the increased wages. That's your third factor.
Right. And there was a big study from Rand Corporation that came out last year that was rather really staggering in its implications, because it said that basically wages in the U.S. have been stagnating for the bottom 90% for the last 40 years, and that roughly $50 trillion had been siphoned from labor to capital by keeping wages suppressed. And so a lot of people that have now reached the point where they simply need more money in order to pay their bills, right? And so that the stagnation has to reverse, and labor has to catch up, or else it's going to be unable to, you know, consume as much as the economy needs. And another factor here was a lot of workers who were laid off in the pandemic had a chance to rethink their priorities and lifestyles and choices. And they decided that they didn't like their previous job and they wanted to move into a different field or start making more money. And so that's also roiling the labor markets.
Yeah, people moving to the countryside from the city, just deciding to retire, right? After what's happened, so that's a big factor.
Yeah, exactly. And so unsurprisingly, like really very difficult jobs such as nursing, you know, during the pandemic, a lot of nurses are just quitting. And so I know some from some correspondents that as the result of that is wages have doubled or tripled, you know, in other words, in order to get nurses, traveling nurses or part-time, you know, to fill in, then wages have skyrocketed. And so, and you can see the same kind of pressure in even lower skill sectors, like hospitality and so on. And my fifth point is,
Go ahead. Just wanted to highlight also the vaccination issue as well, right? In terms of, you mentioned nurses, but also other sectors where either they've quit, maybe they're not comfortable with taking the vaccine, or there's pressure by businesses, right, for either mandatory vaccines for certain sectors or highly encouraged. And so, you know, many workers don't feel comfortable with that. So either quitting or being let go, or so that's also contributing to this trend.
No, absolutely, Richard. That's an excellent point. And then there's all these second order effects of that, which is like nurses who are fully vaccinated, they know that they can still carry the virus, and they don't want to go home and infect their children who are too young to be vaccinated. So there's a lot of consequences to think through for people. And with remote work becoming more popular, then there's, you know, it's like people are willing to sacrifice in order to have a job where they can work from home. The fifth point is that, you know, conventional economics holds that any scarcity can be filled by substitution. You know, the classic being if beef becomes expensive, then people buy chicken. And this is what I call infinite substitution. In other words, the theory of economics is every scarcity can be filled by substitution some way, somehow. And that in the case of, like, say, cobalt or other relatively scarce minerals, that's simply not true. Like many, many, many high-tech devices cannot be fabricated under any conditions without cobalt and other rare minerals. And so and you could take one of my favorite examples is coffee, and I like coffee and tea, but most coffee drinkers will pay a little more to have coffee. They're not going to start switching to an herbal tea. And so there's also like many reasons for there to be no substitute for some commodities. And so that's another reason is the world is now facing hard limits on rare earth metals, cheap to extract hydrocarbons, freshwater aquifers, wild fisheries. I mean, the list is on and on. So, if we can't substitute, then the only option is prices go up. And in other words, price is the factor that rebalances supply and demand. When the price gets high enough, then demand will falter. And that's, I think we're seeing that in a lot of cases.
Yeah, exactly. Next one you
have. And
conventional.
Go ahead.
Economics, your number six factor you list as conventional economics holds that there is a nearly infinite supply of whatever we need to fuel growth.
Right. And so if my point there was that in addition to specifics like cobalt, if the demand exceeds supply, then the price, you know, will rise if demand is inelastic. And of course, I'm thinking when I was say it's like oil and natural gas. I mean, there is some elasticity to that, meaning that people can drive less, they can take fewer airline flights, and so on. So they can move the needle on their demand side. But if we look at a lot of the things that prices are going up in, such as food, the demand is not that inelastic. I mean, people need to eat, right? And so, and they need to, you know, heat their homes in winter and so on. And so the idea that demand can outstrip supply on a relatively permanent basis, that the world is not thinking that that's a possibility yet. It seems to me it's entirely possible, and that we're already seeing the beginnings of that. And my seventh point was that geopolitically, nations are starting to awaken to the fact that they can create an artificial scarcity that improves their profit margins and also gives them tremendous geopolitical leverage. And of course, a famous example is China threatening to limit exports of rare earth minerals, right? But there's many others. And so on top of everything else, you can have geopolitical reasons to create or exacerbate existing shortages. Number eight, I talk about the ratchet effect is what I call it, is that when prices rise in a number of categories, it's extremely difficult to get the price to come back down after it's ratcheted up. Now, if you take a commodity such as, say pork or even semiconductors, when supply, you know, reaches more regular levels and exceeds demand, then the price of the semiconductors or pork bellies will decline, right? But in a lot of cases, prices will not decline. And this is, local government services and taxes and fees. I have never yet heard of a local government that raised fees, taxes, or as a consequence of higher costs for them, and then the price never goes down. And the same is true of rent, that if the rent goes up, it rarely comes down because the commercial landlord could have a lender who is looking at the rental rates and demands high rent in order to justify the mortgage. And so there's just a lot of reasons why a lot of prices are extremely sticky. And these include a lot of services such as childcare, elderly care, and so on. So when prices jump up, they rarely ever come back down. And so that's another push factor in a secular cycle, because as soon as your government, local government fees and taxes go up, your childcare goes up, your rent goes up, then you have to demand more money. You have to make more money, or you have to charge more for your services. And so then you get, this self-reinforcing cycle of inflation, which is what we experienced in the 70s. And my point nine is just to reemphasize that if scarcities deepen due to depletion, like there's just simply not enough fresh water or cobalt available, then you get scarcities that are permanent. And that also goes against the grain of conventional economics, which for the last 40 years has held that there's always some place else that we can exploit. There's always another place we can mine cobalt or we can drill deeper and get to another freshwater aquifer. But we're actually finding that in the real world, there are these hard limits, that there's no more of what people want or need. So that's also going to be a shock to the conventional view. And then my point 10 is, as costs spiral higher in this sort of self-reinforcing cycle I mentioned, it's not just essentials that will go up in price, such as energy, food, and local government. It's inessentials, because, for instance, a restaurant that's suddenly seeing huge leaps in the price of food, in rent, and in their labor, well, they have got to raise their prices to survive. They can't lose money, or else they'll have to close their doors. And so even inessentials will go up in price. And so then you get this spectrum of price increases that you'd say, well, why is that going up? And it's like, well, because that business has higher labor costs, higher local taxes, and higher food costs. And so then you get even more feedback in this self-reinforcing inflation loop.
Interesting. And you have one more as number 10 for... as costs spiral higher, the cost of inessentials will also rise?
Yeah, I think that's, I think that was what I covered in 11 on restaurants. But I want to add a point to that, which is that much of the U.S. economy is controlled by cartels, right? That's like big pharma, healthcare in general, higher education, and telecom, and just on and on and on, right? There's so many cartels and quasi monopolies that, the other push factor in inflation is when those cartels raise prices, consumers have very little option to go and to seek out a competitor that's going to offer lower prices. And so the cartels can get away with it essentially, and consumers are stuck with the bill. So, and we're already seeing that in some of these large food conglomerates that are essentially a cartel, that they're jacking up prices, and there's really no other place to get your canned food because there's only three major companies or two, you know, providing all these different brands, right? So that's another factor, is that once you allow your economy to be dominated by cartels and quasi monopolies, then they can jack up prices, and people have no way to lower the price. There's no other, because there's no competition really in that space. Yeah, so exactly.
And yeah, so I think these 10 represent longer term type of trends, and therefore it's likely we're going to get this longer term secular inflation rather than what people have been talking about in terms of short term transitory inflation. Your thoughts?
Right, exactly. And so then we go, we leads to the question, what can we do as consumers and investors?
Yeah.
And of course,
before we get to that, I just wanted to add maybe an 11th, one more, that it is big as well, is the idea that it's in the interests of governments and central banks that are looking to reduce the burden of excessive debt to actually take advantage of secular inflation to reduce that burden. So, you know, if you do the math, like if you've got 4% inflation for 10 years, it reduces the burden of the debt by about one half. So, you know, you can do some calculations like that. So it is, in the interests for governments and central banks to actually, you know, do a form of inflation for reducing overall debt levels. Your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I'm glad you added that, Richard, because that is really, that's a monumental factor. If we look at, say, the U.S. debt, which has essentially tripled in a very short period of time, right? From, around 9 trillion to 28 trillion or something like that. And yet the debt service, cost to the U.S. government is about the same, right? Because as you say, they've pushed, yields and interest rates so low that the cost of government borrowing has been reduced, as well as, to your point, that the burden on debtors across the whole economy has also lightened up, right? And so and that of course has a perverse consequence, which is like, it's created like a housing bubble, right? Because with mortgages at, you know, 3% or less, then of course you can buy a lot more house. And then of course the price of the house goes up, even though the utility of the house has stayed the same. So, there's that element too. So, how do we protect ourselves from, you know, that erosion of inflation?
That's the big question. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, again, we can look at history and say, I bring that up because, of course, there's examples of hyperinflation, such as Weimar Germany and so on. And, in an extremely high inflation like that, then you're pretty much reduced to, the material world, right? You're owning precious metals, you're owning property, you're owning, you know, farmland that's producing and tools and companies that are producing essentials. And so those tend to go, you know, hold their value, right? But even in so-called moderate inflation, whether, you know, however we define that, 5%, 8%, 9%. Your cash is going to dwindle in its purchasing power, as you say, pretty rapidly in a few years. And so, obviously my choice is to, try to get into a position as a worker, as a laborer, or as a business owner, where you can charge more for your services, that you can at least keep up with inflation in terms of your own income. But beyond that, it's like to look at what commodities are either essential or in permanent scarcity. And so, of course, the top of that list is energy. And of course, we're supposed to be moving away from hydrocarbons. But if we set that sort of fantasy aside, there will be demand for hydrocarbons for the near term. And then, of course, food, you know, and I personally think that there's a lot of potential for scarcities or supply imbalances in commodities such as grains and soybeans, coffee, the so-called softs, you know, the so-called soft commodities.
Yeah.
What do you think is on your list of top inflation positioned sectors that could still have pricing power to raise prices?
Yeah, I think anything that cannot be, you know, printed ad infinitum, so that takes away like government currencies or bonds, but also in terms of the, you know, a lot of people think if I go into inflation protected bonds, but problem with that is all of the financial repression that has happened over time in terms of repression of interest rates, quantitative easing, buying of bonds. So the markets are very distorted. So it's not a true and accurate measure of, you know, inflation protection to get into these inflation protected bonds. So that's not a good source. But yeah, I agree with you. Anything like hard assets, real estate, farmland, precious metals, agricultural commodities, things with scarcity as well, and businesses that have pricing power, as you know, in terms of their sector, the business that they're in. But anything in general that can be inflation hedged or positioned for inflation, whether it be funds or portfolios, and ways of doing business.
Right. And, you know, we've, you and I have had discussions on ESG potential. And I think that's another factor that we can look at, is that some consumers and more likely the higher end consumers, but there is still a factor where consumers will pay more for a sustainably sourced food, timber, etc. And so I think ESG is a potential variable there in pricing power that could work to the advantage of investors. And another factor I think of is reshoring, they call it, where industries that have been offshored we're now recognizing that there's a liability in that number one, we've become dependent on foreign suppliers, but we're also exposed to tremendous price increases for the reasons we've discussed, right? Scarcities of artificial or not. So I think there could be potential to look at industries that are reshoring that produce like industrial piping, right? Pipes and things that are just essential within the construction and industrial economy. And as those come back to the U.S. or expand production here, there's going to be pricing power there because of the sort of general awareness that we need to reduce our vulnerability geopolitically.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree. Yeah, very, very great, good insights on where we're going, why we're going into likely a secular inflationary period. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Charles?
Yeah, please visit me at oftwominds.com. My archives are free, and there's free samples of all my books.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Charles.
Thank you, Richard.